Welcome, proud members of the present, to another episode of the Primalosophy Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Horderbaum, and this episode is brought to you by UFF, the Firefighter Wellness Program on a mission to make the best job in the world a healthier one. Go to primalosophy.com/UFF to get started. James Hollis is a Jungian analyst in private practice in Washington, D.C. He's been teaching for half a century and is the author of 17 books translated into 20 languages. His latest books are Living Between Worlds, Finding Personal Resilience in Changing Times, and Prisms, Reflections on the Journey We Call Life. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be with you, Nick.
So I'm curious, James, what do you think separates a good self-help book from self-help cheesiness?
Well, first of all, I don't particularly like the term self-help simply because it implies that this is easy work. It's the work of a lifetime. And the basic issues of our life will always be with us. And anyone who tells you otherwise is involved in some kind of flim-flam. Mm. The really deep issues of our life are something that we need to wrestle with all our life because we're creatures of history. And whatever has happened with us and to us remains with us. However, that doesn't mean we're prisoners of that history. As Jung said, we don't solve these problems, but we can outgrow them so that they don't play such a determinative role in our lives. That's a big difference. So I think serious psychological help requires that the person learn to go within, find sources of insight and strength and resilience, and a calling, so to speak, higher or larger than the history that we were talking about imposes upon them. When that happens, then you get back in control of your life, so to speak.
Why do you refuse to offer cheery reassurance or a one-size-fits-all recipe for happiness when you know that that's all most people really want?
Well, because I'm not interested in making money with this. This is, if I wanted to make money with it, then I'd write that kind of book. I felt that my first obligation is to tell the truth as I see it, and as my clinical experience has shown me through the decades. So anything else betrays the reader, and I don't want that kind of relationship with the reader.
How can we better raise our children to direct their own lives so that they grow up to serve their values and not their parents' narcissism?
That's an ongoing issue. First of all, a parent to be even able to ask that question has to acknowledge that she or he has narcissistic interests. It's very understandable that parents would want their children to grow up and emulate their values, choose someone to partner with that they would approve of, and perhaps emulate their religious and political choices and so forth. But what if that child's destiny takes a different trajectory? You know, most of the people I talk to are still struggling to escape in some way the snares of those kinds of controlling parental expectations, you know, decades after the fact, even when parents are dead. And so we need to grant to our children the same freedom that we would have liked from our parents. And it begins in two ways. One is to affirm from the beginning to each child who you are is who you're meant to be. You know, we're here to help you and support you and be always mindful of the choices you make, because choices produce consequences. And you want to be mindful of the impact of your choices upon other people. You know, we're not trying to raise a generation of narcissists, but on the other hand, you're here to live your journey. And the second piece, you know, Jung said once, the greatest burden the child must bear is the unlived life of the parent. So in living our journey as fully and as authentically as we can, we open the doors for children. We grant them that permission. Otherwise, we're all bound to, and you see this in terms of the intergenerational sort of transmission of binding complexes, which is why the problems tend to roll from one generation into another. You know, that's been noted from ancient Greek tragedy to the biblical literature and so forth. And it takes somebody coming to consciousness and breaking that skein of cause-effect. And the only way you can do that is with a certain amount of courage or desperation, where you face the influence of something in your past and what is making your choice for you. And the willingness to stand up against it and choose from some other place in your psychological life. When that happens, history is being redeemed and a new freedom opens. But talk is cheap. This is the work of a lifetime, not that you solve it once and forever.
And if this journey is us becoming more and more ourselves, how can we figure out who we are before we grow old and then heed that call instead of resisting it?
Well, that's a very good question. And the truth is, you know, in my early life, I was a college professor and I loved teaching 18, 19, 20 year olds. But I realized, however intelligent and sincere they might have been, in many cases, they just hadn't had the life experience to hang some of these ideas onto them, that you needed to see them when they were 40 and then say, well, now we'll have a different kind of conversation. And one of the reasons I evolved out of being a college professor into an analyst who works predominantly with people in the second half of life is I enjoyed the maturity of that other kind of conversation. You know, by age 40, you will experience the failure, the bankruptcy, the erosion of some of your expectations of life. You will have gone through some hard times, some losses, some disappointments. Maybe your marriage is not so great. Maybe you're having problems in your career. The point is, then you have something truly experiential to address. It's not theoretic anymore. People don't come to see a therapist because they're in the neighborhood and they want to have a chat. They're coming because of two things. One, their previous strategies, if they ever work, are certainly not working now. So, you know, you better go back to the drawing board. And secondly, something inside is hurting enough to get one's attention. If it doesn't hurt enough, why would you go solicit a conversation with a stranger? And then you have to ask yourself, and what's the purpose? Am I talking this over with a stranger? You know, they're not imbued with, divine wisdom. They can't tell me what's right for my life. They can help me, though, into a deeper conversation around the meaning of my own journey. You know, they can help me address those stuck places. For example, whenever we're stuck, we're really being blocked by some kind of archaic anxiety. And so then the question is, all right, so what's that archaic anxiety? By archaic, I mean it's something early in our formation, which we're not aware, at least in terms of its role that it's playing. And then to say, all right, if I want to get unstuck, then I'm going to have to be a little more uncomfortable. I'm going to have to drop the strategy such as avoidance that seems to have worked for me up to this point, but now is producing consequences. When that happens, then you realize, okay, this person now is open to an intrapsychic encounter. The therapist knows, you know, we know certain techniques, we know certain attitudes and practices to employ. We also have seen many sort of situations before. We can work with a person's dreams and so forth. But in the long run, what is right for that person is inside that person. And Jung said once, the question every therapist should ask from the first encounter with the client is, what task is this person's lifestyle or life pattern helping him or her avoid? And then you begin to realize we become a series of defenses built around the things that are most troubling to us. That's understandable. But then that's why we wind up stuck. That's why we wind up drinking too much or having a depression, or it spills over onto our partners or our children. And, you know, those are simply the symbolic overflow areas of what's not being addressed inside of each of us.
The cultural distractions.
Yeah. And in the abstract, this sounds pretty simple, but there's an enormous resistance to that kind of internal, encounter. Most people say, I want to know myself. Well, do you really? There's a price for not knowing yourself, that's for sure. And there's a price for knowing yourself. And are you willing to pay that price? Because it's going to ask of you a greater accountability. It's going to ask that you face your fears. And it's going to ask you to show up in life in ways that really matter. And if you're not up for that, then, you know, go buy a self-help book and see how good that works for you.
And I understand you're working on a documentary exploring the state of the contemporary masculine psyche. How will this film assist in people getting unstuck and their healing process, which is so desperately needed for modern men?
Well, we've virtually finished it. This was entirely a pro bono thing. We're going to donate all of our returns, if we have any, from rentals. to organizations that are working to heal young men and to heal women who've been injured by men, and trying to address the fact that most men very early, as little boys, get shamed away from their inner life. You know, you can't afford to say that hurts. I'm afraid you can't cry. You can't say, I don't want to do that. The price of shunning, the price of ridicule is simply too high. We all got shamed as children. And therefore, that and many other sort of cultural influences separate men from themselves. How can a man have a good relationship with a woman and or his children when he has a terrible relationship to himself? When I've been asked to speak to women's groups about those strange creatures called men, I ask them to imagine three things. First of all, imagine that all of your really close friends are cut away from your life forever. You can never talk about these issues. These are the women that you talk about your marriage with, your fears about your children, what's going on in your body, what's happening, what's your worry. Those people are gone. You can never talk about that. Secondly, you have to sever your link to that within you that you think gives you your sense of personal guidance, call it your feminine instinct or your intuition, whatever it is, that's cut forever. And third, you have to, from here on, consider that you're in a desperate sort of struggle because your worth is going to be depending upon your meeting abstract standards of productivity as defined by total strangers, people you will never meet. And when you meet those standards, the standards will have already been increased. And when you begin to look at those three conditions, you realize that leads to an extraordinary self-estrangement, a psychological and spiritual sort of isolation for men. And when women hear this, there's an enormous softening in their hearts because they think that's horrible. My goodness. And they've often said, well, what can I do to help a man? The answer is very, very little. Men have to address these things themselves. The healing of men is up to men, not women. And until we start doing some of that kind of work, we're going to live strangers to ourselves. And one of the ways in which that then spills into the world is, again, the enormous amount of male violence in the world, which I don't have to sort of recount, and the enormous amount of self-medication that men go through, and the kind of residual depression which most of them are carrying in their lives. And you put those three things together, they're all about living as a stranger to your own life and to your own soul. And that has been the condition of men for millennia. It's not an excuse to say it's always been that way. We're saying now, all right, we've seen the terrible consequences of that kind of self-estrangement and that isolation that occurs. About 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Under Saturn's Shadow, which was really about the sort of cultural expectations of men and how they separated men from themselves. And I was touched and surprised by the letters I got from around the world for people who said in so many words, I always thought there was something wrong with me. But I realized from your book that this is an experience other men have had. And the point is, you see that sense of personal shame. I remember as a child, for example, specifically feeling that if I was afraid of something, that was because I was already a failure at something. I had some kind of internalized image that a cool guy or a hero felt no fear. Well, that's psychotic, you know, that's psychotic. And yet no one bothered to stop and tell that child, you know, it's okay. Now we have to figure out a way for you to, you know, live your life in this world in the face of those fears. They're normal. They're natural. Everybody has them, though they're not going to talk about it. Now you let's figure out a way where you can sort of be happier about how your life's going in the face of those fears. You don't get rid of them. You just don't put them in the driver's seat of your life. And so that's what our film is addressing. And, you know, it's a drop in the bucket, but at least it's our drop.
Do you think today's expectations of men are dehumanizing?
Of course they are. They always have been. Obviously, there have been some changes in the degree of acceptability for these ideas and this kind of conversation among men over the last 50 years. You know, women did their work and are doing their work far more sort of successfully than men are. And if women are facing social constrictions and whatever they have to deal with within themselves in the face of that, well, it's men's turn now. And when I returned from my training in Zurich many years ago, decades ago, I would say my clientele was 90% women and 10% men. Well, today it's 80% men and 20% women. And I think the reason is that more men today are willing to see, you know, I need to do something about this. I can't just continue in this this drift. Something's terribly wrong here, and I'm not figuring it out on my own. So maybe I need to engage in some kind of conversation around this. And so there's a greater cultural permission than there was 40, 50 years ago. And that helps, but we're a long, long way from any kind of genuine transformation of men. It's just the ideas are in the body politic now in a way that they weren't before.
Men are generally adrift and they lack vision, where women just seem to be able to move forward with vision and commitment.
Yeah, I'm deeply impressed with the way young women in particular are stepping into the challenges of their professional life. You know, it was not so long ago in which those doors were not even open to them. It's shameful, but it's a reality. And to see them moving ahead in every field of human endeavor. And there's much there to admire and be proud of. And I see most young men drifting off and wanting to do drugs or play video games all day. Number of young men, and this is apart from, you know, the pandemic and its huge impact on us economically, and I'm not for a moment forgetting that. So many young men living at home with their parents now and playing video games and, you know, basically depressed. They're intimidated by the world out there and depressed because of their circumstances in life. So what do you have? You better look for some form of escape. And video games and pot seem to be the drugs of choice. And it's imperiling a huge generation. And it's mostly the young men. Most young women are, you know, stepping into exploring their options and taking chances. And I'm very impressed with that.
The usual question we ask in life is, will this make me happy? But you say we should ask ourselves, does this path, this choice make me larger or smaller? Can you unpack what you mean by our choices making us larger?
Sure. There is some delusion out there that we're supposed to be happy. And of course, I have nothing against happiness. But happiness is not a steady state. Once again, one would have to be psychotic to be sort of permanently happy. And what a price that would be. Happiness is a transitory experience that comes about from being in right relationship with one's own soul or one's inner life at any given moment, but it doesn't last forever. And so people then have to say, well, what do I need to do to be happy? Well, unfortunately, in our terms or in our culture, the most common form in which it represents itself is material success. So if I buy this automobile, purchase that house, marry this person, all these things will be the accoutrements of happiness and I'll be happy. Well, if that worked, we would see the results because most people have been able to find or achieve those things in their lifetime. How well did that work for you? And then you have to say, but if it's not about happiness, what's it about? And the answer, I think, is meaning. If you're living a meaningful life, you're going to be flooded from time to time with happiness. And when you come to those choices, they're the old fear-based choices. They're the conventional choices. They're the ones that keep you safe. But there are also some choices that when you step into it, it will enlarge you. And when I say enlarge, I mean, it will bring to you new challenges. It will force you to stretch. It'll force you to find what's possible from within you. And everybody in life, women and men, sooner or later has those junctures in life where you're forced to make a very large choice. Many times people have said to me, well, I'd like to do this, but I also have to do this. What do you think I should do? And I'd say, yes, find a way to do both. You know, you have a world of commitments, you have marriage, you have children, and you also want to pursue something that you think really matters to you. Well, figure out a way, you know? When I write, for example, I write at the end of a long workday. I don't have free time to write in, so to speak. My day job is as a therapist, and I've spent a lot of time teaching, still do. But it's in the evenings when I could, you know, kick my shoes off and watch the ball game and have a beer. It's at that time I'm writing. That's how books happen. And, you know, it's like, why do I do that? Well, because I'm a teacher. That's what teachers do. Teachers teach. And these books are classrooms that spread around the world, interestingly enough. And I find it meaningful. I could watch the ball game and that would be fun. But at the end of that, I would also feel, was that the best way to spend your time? As defined from within, not without, you see. And each of us, there's nothing wrong with watching the ball game. It might be clear about that. I'm just saying that each of us has a field of energy inside of us that rises to support us when we're doing what's wrong for us. What's doing what's right for us. But when we're doing what's wrong for us, it abandons us. My first hour of analysis back when I was in my early 30s did not feel at that point like the beginning of a second half of life or a different journey. It's because life visited me with a depression. So there I was at midlife. I'd achieved everything that I thought I wanted, and I was pleased with it. No real dissatisfaction, but there was a depression. And so that's what took me that first hour. And from that point on, I began to learn some things that I had been in service to that I wasn't aware of, that I learned some things that needed to be addressed. I began to access more some other possibilities in my life. And to continue that conversation, I at great risk, traveled to Switzerland and began training and analysis in the Jung Institute in Zurich. And a few years later, had transformed into a psychoanalyst and continued to teach, but I was teaching adult groups rather than youth at that point. And the point being simply that it wasn't like I sat down one day and say, oh, I think I'll change my life. It was because the psyche, for reasons not clear to me at the time, autonomously withdrew its approval and support from where I'd been investing my energies. In other words, if I'm doing the right thing for me, psychologically speaking, something inside provides us the energy. You know, we can mobilize that energy. You get up at 2 a.m. to feed the baby, or you show up at work on Monday, whether you want to or not. That's important. That's part of being a mature adult in a civilized world. But over time, if you're putting your energy in places that don't really matter to you, it leads to boredom, burnout, and ultimately, often self-medication, and ultimately to depression. And then you have to ask the question, all right, so where does my own psyche want me to put this energy? That's a very humbling question. You know, this work doesn't just suddenly make you, you know, the master of your destiny. It means from now on, you're the student, and the teacher is something inside of you that continues to speak and offer directions and critiques to you.
But if you can't hear that inner voice, I mean, how do you make the unconscious conscious? Is it a moment-to-moment task, or do you have a system in place to keep the unconscious upfront in daily consciousness?
Well, that's a very fine question. It's a great question because by definition, we can't say what the unconscious is. I can't say anything about it. And yet things continue to spill in the world through me. So obviously there's some other agencies in there that are making choices as well. And I've always said to people, one of the first places to start to make the invisible world visible is to look at your behavioral patterns, particularly those patterns that you believe are contrary to your best interests, may be harmful to you, may be harmful to others. Now, you don't set out to do self-defeating things, but there they are showing up day after day. So you have to take that and work backwards and say, now, what kind of idea, and I put idea in quotes there, it's an unconscious idea. What kind of idea am I in service to inside of me that produces this pattern? Because what I do out there is logical. If I understand the emotional premise inside of me, That's where we begin to get into those intrapsychic agents we call complexes. Hmm. Also, nature has gifted us with some telltale systems, one of which I've already mentioned, that's energy. When you're doing what's right for you, the energy rises and supports you. At the end of, you know, next month, I'm going to be 81. Most people are dead or retired by now, and, you know, bless them. But at the end of the day, I don't necessarily feel like writing, but something calls me to it. And while I'm doing it, and after I've done it, the energy flows. That tells me something. When it doesn't, then I need to find that which does produce that flow. So energy flow is one of the indications. And when we are forcing it or sludging against it, it leads, as I said, to burnout and depression. Secondly is the feeling function. And that's such a cliche, but remember this, you don't create your feelings. They are autonomous, qualitative responses by your psyche to how things are going as seen by the psyche and not by your ego consciousness. That's why sooner or later, you know, whatever the truth is will emerge in the feeling function. That's why I said before, let's just say you buy the house you've always wanted, the car you wanted, you're married to the person, et cetera, et cetera. Well, maybe your life is better, maybe it isn't. But the real question is, since happiness is so elusive, does your feeling function support you in that, or has it vanished in some way? So when you're doing what's right for you, the feeling function supports you once again. Thirdly, we have dreams, and most people don't pay attention to them. In my profession, we do. Sleep research has told us that we average 6 dreams per night. Everybody's going to say, oh, I don't dream. I don't remember my dreams, or certainly don't remember 6. And that's true. But that would be 42 dreams a week. And nature doesn't waste energy. It's engaging in some kind of invitation to a conversation. And it's offering a perspective. And if I assume, see, you don't make up your dreams. Just let's say this evening, you say, tonight I'm going to have a dream and I'm going to remember it. That might be helpful to remember, might not. And I'm going to dream of hamburgers, or I'm going to dream of Ohio State University. All right. Well, your psyche's not going to pay attention to you. It'll dream whatever it wants to dream about. And then you realize this is an autonomous process going on inside of me every night. Nature doesn't waste energy, so it's serving some purpose. And I think there are 2 functions here. One is to help metabolize the magnitude of stimuli, sensory stimuli and emotional stimuli we receive in any given day. There's a reason why nature is intended that we spend approximately a third of our life journey asleep, where we're repairing and restoring and processing the stressors of daily life, both on the physical front, but on the emotional front as well. But secondly, if you pay attention over time, you begin to realize there is an other in there that knows more about me at a deeper level than I know about me. It's what Jung called the 2-million-year-old person inside of each of us. You know, that's sort of the wisdom of your nature, if you will. Your ego culture knows the demands of the popular culture around you, and the deep psyche knows your true nature as a part of this whole evolutionary process. Now, the two are in dialogue, and if I believe there's something in there that knows me deeply, has my interests at heart, and is trying to engage in a conversation, it only makes sense to pay attention once in a while. And again, so sleep research tells us that if you live to be 80 years old, as I have, you will have spent, get this, 6 years of your life dreaming.
Wow.
That's extraordinary. I find it hard to believe, but the research is there. And that says, you know, there's something important going on there. And then I would say the fourth thing is the most elusive but meaningful of all, and that is meaning itself. In other words, if my life is easy but meaningless, ultimately that rots away the soul. And if it's meaningful, you're willing to put up with lots of difficult things because there's a reward. It's purposeful. It gives your life richness, integrity, and depth. I would have never guessed as a child. You know, as a child, my fantasy would have been, well, be a major league baseball player or something like that, you know, or airline pilot, as children do. Little did I think I would spend most of my days listening to people's difficulties. And yet I can't imagine a more humbling and meaningful conversation to have. And that's why I draw a great meaning. I could have retired by now, but I don't, because this is the most meaningful way I know to live my life. It's not the only way that's meaningful, but it's the way that occupies my daytime life, that's for sure. So the point is, we all have these resources within. Nature gave them to us. We knew it as children, but as children, we also are tiny, vulnerable, and dependent on the world around us. And so we all have to fit in. We develop patterns of avoidance and patterns of complicity, wind up getting pulled into whatever reactive patterns we have to, from the family of origin, schooling, religion, and popular culture, the zeitgeist in which fate has placed us, and lose contact with that. So in some way, the Second Half of Life project is about recovering a relationship to our own internal sense of guidance that we had in the beginning, but, you know, lost through those necessary adaptations. So in a very generalized way, you could say the task of the first half of life is to sort of develop enough ego strength to deal with the world as it presents itself. What do my parents want from me? What does the school teacher want from me? What do my playmates want from me? What does the college want from me? What does the employer want from me? How do I meet those demands and expectations? And that's important. That's how you become a functioning adult in the world. But let's say you reach 40 and then you say, and why am I here now? Am I here just to be a series of adaptations? Then comes the question of meaning. What is worthy of my energy from this point on? What is it? Do I want to just sort of keep repeating myself for the next 40 years? And is this what life is about? And that's a question that's, I think, universal to all of us. Not everybody stops and asks it, but the question then is being asked in the unconscious. And that's why if people don't address those kinds of questions in the second half, they're going to show up pathologically. You know, they're going to be self-medicating, or they're going to have depressions, or they'll start having affairs, or, you know, whatever it is, one will feel a dis-ease that one is carrying and have no way of understanding what that means. That's why Jung said once, neurosis is suffering that has not yet found its meaning. See, we're not spared suffering. That's welcome to the human condition. But if you have meaning to your suffering, you know, the sacrifices that are important for you, that it gives your life a sense of worth and purpose. And if you don't, it's just, you know, miserable suffering.
The second half of life is a recovery process from the mistakes that we made in the first half.
Yes, or build on the strengths that you had too. You know, it's not like just throwing out the first half. Some pieces you want to retain and some pieces you don't. But it's about, you know, you're making a choice that's coming from a different place in you rather than simply responding to all the pressures and expectations upon you. That's a big difference.
When you use the term second half of life, why are you referring to psychologically and not chronologically?
The second half of life doesn't always coincide with the midpoint chronologically. Tolstoy wrote in 1885, The Death of Ivan Illich, whose name translates as John Johnson, so it was meant to be an everyman, who's a man in, I think, St. Petersburg, who lived by all of the expectations around him. He went to the right school. He adopted the right social, political, religious values, married the right person, became a careerist. He was a lawyer and he became a judge, and everything was the way it was supposed to. In other words, he followed the script. And then one day he has a pain in his side that doesn't go away and he doesn't know what's going on. And he runs around in all kinds of denial and then looking for wonder workers. And finally, ultimately, he learns he's dying. And for the first time in his life, he asks the question. And what has my life been about? And the implication is in those last 3 days when he's given up all of the sort of received authority He's trying to find his own truth for the first time in his life. Now, Tolstoy wouldn't have written that over 140 years ago if it hadn't been a kind of universal thing. We all get our instructions. So some people, I'll give you another example. I had a client years ago who learned she was dying of a terminal cancer. She had approximately a year to live, and she realized how much of her life had been constricted by fears and had kept her very, very contained and controlled by her anxiety. And then one day she said, "What the hell am I afraid of? I'm dying. What am I afraid of?" And believe it or not, and you don't have to literalize this, but she took up skydiving, parachuting, and she took up a martial art, all the things she was afraid of. And she said to me later, and she did pass away within that year, she said, "I wish that had come to me in a different form much earlier in my life. What a difference it would have made. But this is the best thing that ever happened to me." You can't say that unless there is a radical transformation of your understanding of yourself. And she was capable of understanding that she was living in a certain way honestly for the first time in her life. And I could give you tons of examples of people coming in who, say, lose a partner or lose a marriage or lose a child or simply one day the bottom of their emotional life falls out and they realize, "Oh my God, who am I really apart from my history? Who am I apart from my roles? They may be good roles, but who am I apart from that?" And when a person really asks that question in a significant and sincere way, then he or she is in the second half of life. And you see, that's not tied to chronology, because some people will sort of skate through life, without ever really asking that question. You could say, well, maybe they're lucky. Well, maybe they may also be living somebody else's life instead of theirs, and you don't know. So sooner or later, I think everyone has an appointment with your own soul, and you're either going to show up or you're not.
Some of that is owed to the proximity of death. It seems like those examples you gave, when death takes the backseat, life tends to take the trunk. It's like once we're finally realize we are dying, then we want to feel fully alive and get to know ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, we're programmed toward death from the beginning. That's not morbid. That's just naturing, you know. But it's not morbid to remember this every day, because it spurs one to say, "All right, then let me not be confined by my fears." Remember, my fears are normal and natural and probably universal. Most people have them most of the time. But I can't let them make my choices for me. And secondly, if I'm not doing something that matters to me, well, let me change that. I mean, it only sounds reasonable when I describe it that way. But, you know, it usually takes something whacking us in the head, you know, to get our attention. And that's what happened to me at that midlife depression, which I now look upon as a blessing, as a self-healing effort of the psyche that said, you know, we're not putting up with you anymore. And, you may be successful by external world standards, but we're not impressed and we're not amused. And we're going to do a work stoppage here and lie down on the job and see how well you deal with that. And, at the time, of course, my first thought was, how quickly do you get rid of this depression and jump right back on the bandwagon? But little did I know, it was, again, the invitation to some substantial choice changes in my life and some periods of uncertainty and living sort of in between. But in fact, the book I wrote a couple of books ago is called Living Between Worlds. We're always between worlds. Culturally, something is always dying and something is trying to emerge. And personally and individually, something in us is always dying and being outlived, and something is wanting to emerge. And sometimes that in-between period is very, very difficult. And then it's also discussing the role of the resilience that our own nature has within us. Something in us gives us support and strength to push our way through if we are willing to align our consciousness with that. That's why Jung said once, in a way that I think about every day, he said, we need to know what supports us when nothing supports us. And when you figure that out, you realize I have something inside of me that will always be there and carries me and tells me what's right for me. Then it's up to the ego upstairs to execute that in the real world out there and manage it as best he or she can. But at least I have that sense of guidance. I know what's the right course for me.
Know what supports you when nothing supports you. Would you also say that now you have psychological tensile strength?
Yes. And I always did, but I didn't know it. I would say all of us have more tensile strength than we know. And that's why sometimes we have to go through hard times to realize we come out the other side. Churchill said once, when you're in the middle of a dark forest, keep walking. And that's how you get to the other side. You don't run from it. You don't just over-medicate it. You keep walking and you find what its meaning is. And then you address that. And when you do, that's when change occurs. That's why I sort of hesitated when you first asked about self-help books. They don't address this stuff at all. It's always 5 easy steps to this or that, 30 days to this or that. Well, if that worked, I'd be first in line. It's usually superficial and doesn't last. You have to go through, in some way, a death and rebirth for every substantial advance in your psychological formation or your psychological maturity.
So why does aging bring wisdom for some and regression for others?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, age does not equal wisdom. I know a lot of old fools, some of them in high office and so forth. And what you really have to do is, are you paying your dues along the way? Are you working on something here? You know, if you're not, you're just not going to suddenly become Socrates at the end of your life. You know, it's like you don't get there without, in a sense, being willing to suffer consciously, because you're often suffering unconsciously and just trying to sort of keep one step ahead of that.
Only those who are still intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually growing inherit the richness of aging.
That's exactly right. That's right. And I would say, for that reason, while I would happily trade in certain bodily parts at age 80, this is the richest time in my life, because I'm aware of so much more, and I'm so grateful for that. I wouldn't go back if going back meant the loss of what has been paid for and earned.
You've said it's the privilege and the duty at this stage in your life to step back and reflect a bit on the bigger picture and what one has learned along the way. Do you also feel that it is your duty at this stage of life to inform society of what you've learned?
Yes. And that's what most of the books are about, because it's about, in some way, raising the right questions. You know, if we're not asking good questions, we'll not have a good life somehow, you know. You ask important questions, they'll lead you to a different life, and I think a richer life. Secondly, you know, one of the things that's really missing in our time is our mentors. And a mentor is not a person who's here to tell you what to do. It's quite the contrary. It's to help you address the basic questions you need to address and perhaps engage in some kind of conversation with you around that process, until you find, you know, your path. So mentoring is the role I play as a therapist and as an author and as a teacher. So, I mean, I'm grateful to people that I learned from in the past. And I'm not just talking about intellectual content. I'm talking about those that I learned from them about how do you get through these issues of life? And what is it I need to know to equip myself?
And I think this is why we've lost sight of what's important in life, is because people don't seem to reflect or stop to share the wisdom that they've gained throughout their journeys.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You know, a lifetime of going off and playing golf, which is wonderful for some person, certainly, not knocking it in any way, it wasn't right for me. I would be bored very quickly. So that's why I keep my practice going and I keep writing, because I learn from them, you know. When I have a quote right here on my computer, and by the painter Chuck Close, who went through a catastrophic impairment to his own health, but wound up painting in an entirely new way. And people say, well, you know, do you sort of wait for inspiration to write a book? And no, you sit down and you start worrying about some topic and you don't know what you know, but then you start messing with that and it starts messing with you. And then something begins to emerge of it. I don't know what I know until it has emerged out of the dialogue from within. So the Chuck Close quote right here in front of me is, inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. And I think that's exactly right. We show up, get to work, and you know, something inside responds. And if it doesn't, then I'm doing the wrong work. I need to find that work, which is, and I'm using work in a very generalized way. We need to find that work that really does reciprocate and reverberate for us.
In Living Between Worlds, you wrote, there is no arrival, a place where we will be finally content. All arrivals are way stations on the path to the next journey. Can you describe your current way station and how it's bringing you closer to wholeness?
I can't presume it's closer to wholeness, but I also know I'm on a path that feels right for me. In the last 16 months, I have been dealing with the medical world for two cancers, prostate and bladder cancer. I've been in two surgeries, many in invasive procedures, periodic shots, periodic tests, many chemo infusions, and 40 sessions of radiation. Plus, 6 weeks ago, I had a hip replacement, total hip replacement. So for the last 16 months, I've been reporting to the hospital, sometimes in some parts of that daily. And I work full time through that. And I think when it became clear to me that's what lay ahead, I thought, well, that's another imposition on my schedule, but I'll work it in. I am not going to let this be the center of my life. At worst, it's an annoyance. At best, I'm going to learn a lot from the process. And I have, and I'm grateful for the presence of modern medicine and the many wonderful technicians who have worked to extend my life. And the telemetry at present indicates a very good prognosis. So I'm grateful for that. You know, otherwise I would have been dead. And I think about it every day, but I don't preoccupy because I'm not going to give it any more space than I want it to have. And therefore this work is even more precious, even more meaningful to me. And I keep asking myself, you know, is there anything? I mean, the one thing that's missing in my life along with everyone else is I'm truly missing travel, but I'm hoping time will produce that possibility again. But short of that, I have a terrific marriage and I have friends scattered around the planet and we communicate and I have good work. What more could one ask for? So I'm mostly grateful.
Well said, James. All right. If you'd be so kind as to share what's on your shelf, are you reading anything good right now?
Right now, I'm reading, I swear at night, I'm not reading anything that is about psychology. I'm reading a spy novel because I just like the release of it. That's my equivalent of a golf game. So when I go to bed, I'm reading a spy novel.
And if you were forced to give away all of your books except for one, which one would you keep?
Well, I'll cheat and I'll make it The Collected Works of Jung, if you allow me that, because I still find myself learning from them. And some of them were written 100 years ago, but they're insights to the psyche once you strip away some of the topical references due to that time and place, still find elemental insights into the nature of the human psyche. And that's why you heard me quoting Jung several times a day, simply because this is part of the fabric of my life and gives me a lens by which to understand things.
And if you could have a drink with anyone in history, who would you choose and why?
I've always had a predilection for Abraham Lincoln. I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, and you know, Lincoln is a giant there, as you know. And I had ancestors who were ostensibly friends of his in Springfield. So I would think Lincoln, and I'd like to talk to him about, he went through so much suffering. His life was cut so short. And during his administration, even, he was so savagely indicted, not only by, you know, the rebel forces, but by the newspapers and editors of most of the North who wanted a quick victory, or they wanted a quick end to the war and so forth. And his vision and his persistence, I find extraordinary. And I would like to just have a moment to talk to him and say, you know, our work is going on. It's not complete. We know that for sure. But I want you to know that something good came from that. And, you know, your suffering was truly with some genuine contributions to this world. People don't realize how much that man suffered until you've really studied his biography, and for a lot of reasons, from his own troubled childhood to his very disturbed partner to the, you know, the terrific and horrific politics of his time.
Awesome. If people want to find you, they can go to jameshollis.net. I'll have links to your books in the show notes below. Is there anywhere else that you would like people to go to connect with you?
No. From time to time, I'll put places where I'm speaking via Zoom online. If people are interested, they're welcome to join. And that's been one of the beauties of this sequestering, is we've allowed people at great distances who wouldn't have an opportunity to talk to each other, just as you and I are talking right now, to link up via Zoom. So I think it's making a permanent change to our world, and this happens to be for the better.
You can count me as a fan. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
You're very much welcome, Nick, and I wish you well.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow me on social media at Primalosophy. And if you want to subscribe to my weekly newsletter, Sunday Goods, you can find the link in the show notes. Shakoba.